Welcome to the Animus podcast. Today we're going to be talking with Nick Thorpe. He's one of the Animus trainers in Edinburgh. He's also a coach and a writer. He's going to be sharing with us his journey as a sailor across the Pacific to a life coach and a trainer. He's also going to be talking about the rites of passage with men and the work that he's currently doing. Hey Nick, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Robert. Nice to be here.
So I'd love to sort of hear your journey from travel writer and journalist to coach and trainer of coaches.
Yeah, it's not a very conventional journey, is it? I started out as a journalist, went to Edinburgh when I was in my early 20s and started on the evening news doing all of those kind of big front page stories about conflict and who's done what to who. And I suppose in a way that was an early kind of questioning that I was getting used to. So there is a bit of a link, because obviously coaching is all about decent questions.
Yeah.
I suppose I've seen the kinds of questions I'm asking changing over the years. So I got really interested in feature writing as I went on, and I got to sort of delve under the surface and talk to people in the news who might not be that sympathetic on first approach. So, for example, I did a lot of work in Northern Ireland around the time of the Good Friday Agreement, and there was lots of very stubborn-looking people sitting in roads or banging drums or kind of saying, "We will not be moved." I think what I learned from that was that actually anybody, if you ask the right questions and ask sympathetically, they have a coherent story that explains the way they are and why they've come to the place that they've come to. And I found throughout all my journalist career, which went for 20 years or so, I never really found somebody that I couldn't find something interesting to talk to about. So maybe that was where coaching came in later on.
You're really honing your ability to ask questions and to listen as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you think about the way that news journalists anyway, tend to hone in on what's wrong or kind of what the discrepancies are or try and get people to argue against one another, I very quickly got tired of that kind of question. I suppose as a coach, I'm learning to be more and more open and more non-prescriptive, asking non-binary questions, open questions, all that stuff you teach us in the modules, which I'm now teaching, of course. Yeah.
So when was the shift for you then from the sort of the journalistic stuff to the more coaching stuff?
Well, I had a kind of midlife crisis. I was writing my second book. I was a travel journalist actually. After a while, I didn't say that, but I got very interested in journeys, kind of outer and inner, and outer journeys as an excuse to delve into why are we here? What's the point of it all? And they were great. They were very kind of testing myself physically against the world. I built a raft and sailed across the Pacific with some guys that I met in Chile. I hitched on other people's boats around the coast of Scotland for a summer. And I suppose all through my life until that point, I'd been using basically willpower, so forcing myself to do the next thing. And when I was writing up the second book, which is about hitchhiking on other people's boats, I was sitting at my desk like I'd done many times before, kind of beating myself on to reach a deadline, saying, you've got to do this, Nick. It's got to be in by next Friday or else. And it's like my hands went on strike. I mean, it was really kind of a weird moment. I was like, come on, let's get this thing done. And my hands just didn't type. And actually, at the time, it was really kind of scary. I thought, what the hell? Am I having some sort of stroke or nervous breakdown? And actually, I think it was the end of that way of forcing myself to do stuff. And in a way, that's kind of analogous to performance coachy sort of ways of doing stuff, isn't it? We kind of get ourselves to do stuff by setting targets and so on. And for me, that was a big paradigm shift of realizing I couldn't do that anymore. I had to find a different way of motivating myself. And basically, at that point, I thought, what would happen if I let go a bit and took my hands off the handlebars and just surrendered? So kind of humiliating, but also a bit of a relief. I had to take some time off. I had to bust some deadlines, and nobody died. It was it was I failed to deliver those deadlines, but it was okay. And over a period of months, I started thinking, how can I pull something from a different place in me? Is there another way of doing it rather than jumping through hoops? And I thought, that could be a great journey. I could go on a journey again, but this time I'll go and look for people who have learned how to let go. So who don't do this whole "come on," but are kind of "hey, man." Sure enough, I spent a year again wandering around the world, talking to hippies and monks and naturists and school kids, clowns, anybody who had something to say about sort of non-normal ways of motivating themselves. Actually, my dog was probably the biggest teacher in that. Like, how does my dog manage to do that thing where he just lies in the sun? And it really has changed my life since doing that, because I've kind of befriended a bit of myself that before I was kind of at war with. And for me, that's where the coaching has sprung from, this kind of, what if you don't need to force yourself to do anything? What if you just need to befriend that bit of you that you're so keen to get rid of? What if you just need to say, "Oh, who are you, and why are you doing what you're doing, and what is it I could thank you for here?"
Okay. So that sort of reminds me of some of that shadow work. Looking at that dark side of ourselves, mm-hmm. that hidden part, and going, okay, what if I befriend that? What if I shine some light on that and bring it out of myself, sort of hiding it away?
Yeah.
What happens then? What's the difference that shows up?
Yeah, I mean, the shadow's been absolutely crucial to me. And I always thought, you talk about the dark side of yourself. I was brought up in a religious upbringing. It was very evangelical in my youth, and dark meant bad. Mm. But actually, what I've learned as I've got older is that these parts of ourselves are just the bits that we deny or hide or repress and stuff them into what we call the shadow, what I think Jung probably called the shadow. And actually, when I delve in and say, "Okay, come out, let's see what's, come on, I want to see you and know you," what I discover is that there's a part of myself that's trying to help in some way, but in a slightly dysfunctional way. Mm. And that's been my work, actually, has been to learn to do that for myself, because I can't really do anything or help anybody else go places I haven't been myself. And it's been a revelation, yeah.
And as you talk about this, I'm sure this will resonate with you. I just think of Joseph Campbell's work of the hero's journey, and how we go on these journeys and find new parts of ourselves and find new guides and spirits and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the work I've been doing has been with men, actually, over the years. Before I formally trained as a coach, I've been sort of doing self-development work ever since Scott Peck's The Road Less Travelled, really trying to find a way. And I think I found Joseph Campbell really chimed in when I started doing rites of passage work with men in particular, because until I was about 40, I basically thought, as men, we're kind of the problem. I didn't feel, "Great, I'm a man, hey, excellent." I just thought, look at the statistics, all the things that go on, war, rape, whatever it is, what is there to be happy about being male? And then I met a guy who ran these kind of weekend initiations, you call them, or rites of passage, and went and did all sorts of strange things in the Scottish Highlands, delved deep into my emotions, did a lot of roaring. Can't say very much about it. It was quite a sort of private process.
Right.
But I came back feeling utterly different about men. Just thought, I met some magnificent men who I thought, wow, you have done your work. You've gone into all this stuff that a lot of us push down into shadow. And, the whole thing about Joseph Campbell's hero's journey is that you have to kind of go down before you can come up.
Yeah.
You have to go into the darkness. And that's a sort of, there's a challenge and a bravery to that. I love that. We don't get to do that sitting in offices much, do we?
And suddenly, I don't think we do at all. No. Well, I suppose sometimes when you're writing something or you're producing something, sometimes it feels like you're going into that darkness. Or I suppose it's that threshold thing. So I'm really curious about this idea of these thresholds, these invisible thresholds that we pass through that we can feel resistance about. And I think sometimes when we're in those more normal spaces, office spaces where you can feel those thresholds kind of knocking on the door, as it were.
Yeah, actually, you just saying that's reminded me of what the probably the most important experience I've had in the last few years is that the friend who introduced me to men's work and to that whole Joseph Campbell rite of passage stuff, very dear friend of mine got cancer, and I was working with him at the time, and how he dealt with his illness really modelled to me something really important that I've taken into coaching. I mean, he went from being a really healthy guy, he was my age, sort of late 40s, had a bit of back pain, and then one day collapsed and went into hospital and discovered it was a spinal tumour, lost the use of his legs, and was in hospital, and it was a very aggressive thing. And loads of people were obviously coming to see him. He'd influenced so many of us, and saying, "Oh, this is terrible, what's happened to you? You know, you've really got to fight this battle, this cancer." And he was really interested. He sort of said, "Do you know what? I really get where you're coming from, but I don't want to use that sort of language about it. I don't want to be fighting anything. I want to find a way of being with what is and living through this." He sort of came alive in a way that was remarkable through his illness. I mean, I still find it quite hard to talk about, actually, because he would say, I would say, "It's terrible that you've suffered so much, David." He was called David. And he would say, "Well, it's funny, isn't it? I don't really feel like I've suffered in that way, because in order to suffer, I would have to tell myself that what's happening to me shouldn't happen. And actually, I haven't told myself that." And to me, that like lit up the whole idea of where a lot of our suffering comes from. Certainly, where a lot of mine comes from is this commentary that we lay on top of what's actually happening. I mean, he would talk about living in the present moment, which often, as coaches, we think without really thinking much about it means some sort of nirvana, some kind of bliss, peaceful present moment. What's not to like? But present moment can also be pain and present moment can be him needing to tell his son that he's just had a terminal diagnosis and he's not going to be around, which he had to do. So being present in the present moment can simply be allowing what is happening to happen without laying on some story about it should or shouldn't be happening. I mean, that's stayed with me ever since. And he died. I mean, he died 14 months after going into hospital. And I was kind of accompanied him a lot of the way through that, because I was working with him as well as his friend, and had to write his obituary and all sorts of things. And he's kind of a shining example for me of how to be male and how to do your work.
Wow, that's kind of... Those moments, I think, really touch us and can be huge influences in how we work and what we do. And as you were talking about that, I was thinking, you know, you're saying that overlaying of stories and how we, you know, we create these stories in our minds of what things mean, and that the suffering that we can cause ourselves because we go, "It means this."
Yeah, yeah.
And how, you know, as a coach, we can help people think about what else it means. And as I say that, I sort of go, "But I wonder how I would be with somebody in that position."
Yeah.
I might want them to fight, and it might create that challenge of, I want, you know, they're going, "That's not the language I'm using," and my desire to see them get better, I suppose.
Well, he wasn't, and he didn't give up. He wasn't saying, "Have me cancer." Mm-hmm. He was saying, "Have me life. I'm living this life. I refuse to get into an oppositional kind of mindset." You know, he wanted to live more than anything else in the world. He really did. But there was a kind of surrendered practice about what he was doing that modelled something. I mean, there were people who said, "Come on, fight, fight, fight." And it's the way we approach illness and death, you know. I mean, we're all going to die, aren't we? So one of those truths that often doesn't come up in the sort of very positive world often of coaching. We don't really talk much about the one thing we all know about ourselves. Well, the only thing we know about ourselves is that we're going to die.
I suppose from an existential point of view, we may face that idea that if this is something we can develop a good or bad relationship with.
Yeah. I mean, I like thinking about... who's the guy who wrote the logo therapy? Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
you know, because often coaching gets portrayed as this slightly woo-woo thing that's only really possible for middle-class people. But he was in Auschwitz, you know, and his whole thing was, you know, the one thing that's left to us as people when everything else has been taken away is the ability to decide how we respond. And I think it's amazing that somebody in that position, and you know, my friend was in a not dissimilar position facing death, could do that.
So I'm curious about how might this work and these experiences show up within the coaching that you do?
Well, interestingly, the people who seem to come to me are, they're often men, not exclusively men, but they're almost always in midlife transition. And they're typically, they've often done well in their life, they've done what they thought would make them successful. They're earning money, but something inside says, this isn't it, this isn't what I wanted. And so they're facing this kind of existential, what's life for? And a lot of them come hoping I can restore, or help them restore, obviously it's not my job, but to help them restore what they feel they've lost. But I think the most empowering thing of all can be to suggest that maybe this is exactly the path that we all need, that we all walk at some point. I mean, the hero's journey, Jung would have put it in terms of the first half of life and the second half of life. And the first half of life is about building your tower, your kind of identity, your sort of, here's who I am in the world. And then he would say that the second half of life is about kind of deconstructing that and self-actualizing and all of this deeper stuff about meaning. And so I tend to end up with those clients who come to me and sort of want to some sort of accompaniment through a really significant transition, whether it's giving up a job, whether it's giving up a relationship. Actually, I have, yeah. So it could be transitional moments, which I'm not telling them to do anything particularly other than just hearing it, but even just to allow them to feel that this is okay and that this is actually a legitimate road that many of us have to walk. Because I think we've sort of cheapened the idea of the midlife crisis into kind of buy a pair of leather trousers or a sports car, you know. But actually, what if the midlife crisis is just as crucial as everything else in life, as adolescence? You know, midlife crisis is where you pivot and decide how you're going to be and who you're going to be in the world. So it's a real privilege to work with those people. I didn't ask them all to come to it. I think you kind of attract the people who are, I guess they maybe see from what I put on my website about my own periods of stuckness, oh, here's somebody who's not going to think I'm a failure because I feel stuck. I think men in particular struggle with feeling stuck, like it's something we've done wrong.
With all the coaches I speak to, there's something about when we are our authentic self in that space of sharing what we do and who we are as a practitioner, that we get people who can resonate with that. I think there's something really interesting about enabling ourselves to just be, you know, this is who I am, this has been my journey, and if you would like to work with me, then you can choose to do so, and people can really tap into wanting to do that or not.
Yeah, whereas the model of normal office life in a way is wearing a series of masks, or can be. As I've taken up sort of training with Animas and so on, one of the challenges has been to both be professional and a good ambassador for Animas, but also to be utterly myself. And how do you balance that?
How do I balance that? I think it's really interesting, because I was going to say to you, being a trainer, what's that also like? Just to answer your question, I suppose, about the balance, I think it's about being authentically professional.
Right.
I think for me, there is a real sense of, I've got to be me in the space, because we've all been to events or trainings where we've seen a mask present something, or somebody in armour presenting something, and we go, we don't know who that person is. And I think in the work that we do, we are also modelling authenticity, also modelling showing up and that sense of being in the now. But I'm also aware that I'm holding the space for learners or for learning. I'm holding the space for learning, I'm being authentic, but I am holding a space, so that's, I have a role to play within this as well as being myself.
Yeah, which is the same in the coaching space in some ways, isn't it? You could tell your own story to a client, but actually that's not really great practice. even if you feel it would resonate, sometimes holding back that thing that you feel you could share, in my experience, has been the right thing. As you learn, as I learn, I've, you know, once or twice somebody's begged me to say, so how was it for you? Because I saw that you were stuck. What was your story? And
yeah.
I told it and thought, okay, that's why you don't fully share your story, because actually it takes the focus off the client who you're there to serve and makes it about you.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, sometimes it's given somebody permission to think, oh, it's not just me then.
Which is really interesting when we're training coaches about this. So I was training foundations in Berlin recently, and people were saying, you know, should I do this or should I do that? And I was going, well, it's about what feels right in that moment with that client. It's like there are no black and white answers here. It's all about experimentation, exploration, and conversation, communication with our clients to explore what we might do and when we might do it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I'm in a slightly unusual position as an animus trainer on one hand, and also as a writer, I've been very self-revealing in all of my books. I mean, they're very kind of vulnerable books about very sort of deep experiences I've had. So it's out there. So I can only be who I am as well, but I guess, yeah, what can I say?
It's quite interesting because I was talking about actually Liz Goodchild, who is one of our trainers in Berlin, and she writes a lot of stuff about herself on her blogs and kind of talked about who she is, and that's kind of out there in the world. But what I notice is that people choose to work with her because that's out there.
Right.
Because it's not hidden. It's like she's sharing her own vulnerability. I guess that's part of what you're doing as well.
Yeah, and I've had more than one client say, oh, you said on your website that you were stuck professionally and personally for a while. That's why I'm here, because I'm stuck, and I wanted to find someone who wouldn't think I'm a loser for being stuck.
Yeah, I think, especially from, I don't know if this is especially men, but I recognise that some of the men that I've spoken to are afraid to show that side of themselves because they think they should know the way forward and they should be able to act.
And why have we told them that? I mean, this is why myself and Emma Dempsey, the other Edinburgh trainer, my friend, we've been really kind of working on a whole new rollout of workshops and CPDs on celebrating boys, because of this sort of you know, decades old, centuries old, I guess, story about what it is to be a boy, what it is to be a man. And you know, you can be a fully card-carrying feminist and believe that the patriarchy has really screwed up women's experiences, but also to recognise that it hasn't been great for men either. We haven't done ourselves any favours sort of cutting off that whole nurturing part of ourselves and telling ourselves that we have to be strong and brave the whole time and not vulnerable and stiff upper lip and all that stuff.
And recognising that vulnerability is bravery, is courage, is is strength in itself.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is the work of Brené Brown, as it were.
Oh, yeah. Brené Brown Appreciation Society. Yeah. No, she's great, isn't she? I mean, and shame, actually, it was another big one for men. She talks about just how it actually prevents us from feeling rather than... shame's got that sort of fog, isn't it, that kind of covers over all the other feelings and actually prevents us from taking responsibility but also from grieving properly.
That numbing sense as well.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one thing I've seen doing work with men in groups, it's how much grief there is. I mean, unbelievable. Sometimes when you allow the emotions to come up, they start out as anger. And then as soon as the anger's had a chance to dissipate itself in a safe container of men, out comes this grief. Grief. Just such a lot of tears and, you know, there's an ocean of it out there. And it's such an honour to sort of allow men to feel that stuff and to welcome it and say, this is welcome here.
Yeah, it reminds me of the sort of the bereavement cycle. It's like, you know, we've lost something that we didn't know we lost. And through that experience, we can kind of get in touch with it. But part of getting in touch with it, we grieve having lost it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, grief work is so important for men, I think, and so hard to find a place to do it. You know, I go with my son to the football match and watch Hibs play, which involves a lot of grieving, for him at least. And I notice how emotional men are watching football. Just one example, you know, we channel it into the acceptable places for men to feel emotion.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I wonder if that's why it's so popular, because it's a space where we can cry And we can have such elation and joy, and it's accepted.
I think so. I mean, that's one of the socially sanctioned, acceptable places to do that. We need more.
I hadn't kind of connected that dot before. That's really interesting.
It's a great journey. I mean, I feel really honoured when I'm with a client in that one-to-one space, sort of witnessing this stuff and welcoming it. I think, what better job is there in the whole world, you know? And it's such a different quality as well to the sort of scatteredness of an ordinary life. I feel more and more overwhelmed normally by just the number of channels of communication that are coming in. And coaching, one-to-one, phones off, you, me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's beautiful. It's so much a relief after all of that. Or Facebook pinged up or something. Up, you know. Please, let me
out. It's interesting because I was talking the other day where somebody was saying, you know, they wanted to get off of all of that stuff. And I was saying, I quite enjoy all of that stuff. What's going on there? But I suppose there are ways of using it, perhaps, or.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it suits different personalities as well. I guess I'm towards, I don't like the term introvert, but I guess I'm towards that end of the spectrum. And for me, I recover in solitude in order to engage with people who I love. But it's way easier for me to be overwhelmed now than it was 12 years ago before smartphones came in.
Yeah.
And now I have to guard boundaries much more fiercely if I'm not going to find myself thinking, well, why did I come up here again? Or what did I go on my phone again to look for?
It's so easy to pick it up and get carried away in the world of the phone.
Yeah.
So I recognise that it can also steal time, I think.
In a way, it's a sort of fake, it feels to me a fake version of flow. You know, that kind of concept of a peak performance when you're really in the zone and you're just going from one thing to another and you wait, you can go, wow, where am I? Oh, I'm here. I've been writing my novel for two hours or whatever.
Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
Yes.
That's his name.
Thanks for pronouncing that for me, Robert. I mean, he's great. But I'm not sure that sometimes the things that feel like flow, you know, the swipe screen, that, I mean, all of that, you can go for hours without becoming conscious that you're doing it. I'm not sure how
I think that's lost. I think we're lost when we're doing that, not in flow when we're doing that. I feel like that's when we're falling down the rabbit hole as opposed to being in flow. Because I think flow also brings an energy about it. And when we come out of flow, we can notice something's been achieved through that flow motion.
Yeah.
And I think when we're in the rabbit hole, it nothing happens. If anything, things are diminished through that experience.
Yes, and it's a very different quality from the sort of peak experiences of... in fact, I think it's you that recommended Stealing Fire, that book.
Yeah.
I mean, just that whole idea of those peak moments, whether it's, you know, through the euphoria of a football match or through the... you know, a trance gig or magic mushrooms, God forbid, or whatever it is, a religion. I mean, I first experienced that kind of those sort of moments of altered states through evangelical religion. So I think I've never quite given up searching for that in other places since then. But it sure isn't Facebook.
So it was. I think it was Bronwyn, one of our other trainers, our London trainers, that introduced me to Stealing Fire.
Mm.
And we've sort of been exploring it as a team as to how can we create those moments together. So how can we come together and have those experiences to create a bonding of teams? And you know, I think about team building events and go, you know, something that we all used to go off and do, but when you're choosing to be part of something that's going to help us to be part of something else, how wonderful that can be.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it brings me back to this, because I've always wondered what made me sign up for an expedition on a raft, because I started off talking about going to Easter Island on a reed boat that we built ourselves with this team of 8 people. And in a way, my motivation for that was a mystery to me till many years after, as I thought about, why did I do that? Because it was slowly sinking from the moment we set sail, and it was a bit crazy before I had a son. Looking back, it was actually about wanting to achieve that peak bonding sort of team experience of, we're out here against the odds, we've got 1,000 miles between us and the nearest landmass, we've got to stick together or else we could die. We're right back to kind of primal states here. And we were. And I think there's a bit of me, anyway, that misses that, that kind of core experience.
I think it's really interesting. As I get older, I sort of go, there's something about having those experiences. But I think I had a lot in my earlier years, when I was performing and touring, there were lots of peak experiences that I had. Mm. And then it kind of died off for a while. And now I feel there's a bit of me that's like, what is that next?
Yeah.
That next thing, yeah. Or that next group of things. I don't think it's one singular thing.
No, that's right. And it can get a bit addictive. I remember sort of wanting to keep experiencing euphoria through religion, for example, when I was younger. And I'm still looking for that, whether it's, you know, through dancing or whatever it is I do to kind of get out of my head and into the sort of bigger group hive mind.
So, you know, as we're talking about, you know, rites of passage, working with others, keep creating group experiences. Your coach, you're also one of our trainers of coaching. I'm sort of going, where next for you? Is there something that's been built or explored?
Yeah, I mean, I've just handed in my notice in actually for my day job, which is a brilliant day job, but sort of campaigning to get dads more involved in those sort of nurturing roles. It's a kind of gender equality job that I first went into because of my friend that I mentioned earlier. Who died, but I've realised that there's just too much going on, and so I've taken this step of leaving that in order to make more room for some writing again, hopefully, because it's been a while since I've had time to sit and write. But also I think this Celebrating Boys strand that myself and Emma are building, hoping to go a bit further with that, build up my client base, but also to start working more intensively with rites of passage, whether that's with younger men or kind of I ran a rites of passage this summer for men aged 18 to 28 out in an old quarry in Northumberland, and just seeing the transformation in them after 5 days of kind of a really useful physical rituals and grieving and whatever it is that needed to come out. I can't say much about that, but I'm really open to building on that, so both a bit of group work and also the one-to-one that I so love. And we'll see where we go. I'm not sure whether I want to niche any more than I already am niching. I seem to be detracting the people who I need to coach, so whether I want to market that or not, I don't know. But we shall see. There's a sort of surrender to it, actually. I mean, it feels like one of those moments where it's time to fall backwards into whatever and jump in the river and see where the river takes me, rather than do the pragmatic... keep all the irons in the fire, keep this job so that, you know, don't take any risks. It's a sort of emotional risk taking that I've forgotten about in the last couple of years. I want to go back into in order to expand as a business and as a person.
Wow, this is absolutely fascinating. I'd love to get you back at some point to talk a little bit more about how that's sort of growing and what that's turning into. So as well as being one of our trainers, you do your own work. So if people want to find you, where might they find you?
I just go to my website, which is www.nickthorpe.co.uk. And there's links to my coaching work and some other stuff I do on that one. So it'd be the best way.
Cool. It's been great having this conversation with you, Nick. And I look forward to many more.
You too. Thanks, Rob.
Cheers.